Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. And as Netflix is a Joke Fest comes to an end this weekend in LA, we are sharing one more throwback episode with the one and only Margaret Cho. Margaret and I had an incredible conversation about her trailblazing comedy career in the studio back in the fall of 2019, which was only enhanced by the mostly quiet presence of her adorable chihuahua, Lucia. We talked about everything from being directed by her one-time boyfriend, Quentin Tarantino, to acting opposite John Travolta and Nicolas Cage in Face Off, and a lot more. And somehow, even 3 years ago, we were talking about Dave Chappelle's anti-LGBTQ jokes, so you're going to want to stick around for that as well. Margaret is headlining tonight, May 6th, at the Wiltern Theater, and will be part of Standout, an LGBTQ plus celebration tomorrow night, May 7th, at the Greek Theater, which is hosted by Billy Eichner and also features previous Last Laugh guests Tig Notaro, Sam J, River Butcher, Fortune Feimster, Joel Booster, and more. That should be a really fun show, so if there are still tickets available when you're hearing this, check it out. But for now, here's my conversation with Margaret Cho. Does Lucia have a lot of podcast experience?
Yes, she... Usually she will be sitting in pretty much on every one, on the one that I do, mm-hmm. and also on anyone, a guest of anybody else's. So she's been around media for a long time.
Yeah, well, I'm so happy to have you here because I'm such a big fan of yours.
Thank you.
I've been listening to your podcast.
That's great.
How long have you been doing it now?
Well, I started it in July. However, I have been, I was at the very dawn of podcasting in 2012, really long time ago. And I did a lot of episodes, and it was a different kind of a game then. It was much more indie and much more casual.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had a recorder and going all over to like festivals, and interviewing a lot of musicians actually for that one.
Oh, yeah.
People like Bob Mould and John Worcester, my friends, Jason Nardesi, pretty much every member of Superchunk and Mountain Goats and Bob Mould Band and Fred Armisen came in and did stuff. And so, you know, it was very indie rock, but it was fun. But this is different. Now it's a lot more of it's like a very lady podcast, and we're in my house, and it's kind of like Whoopi Goldberg's old talk show.
Oh yeah, well, I don't remember that.
Remember, it was a really,
before The View.
It was way before The View, and it was like a late night one. So instead of 11:30 in the morning, it was 11:30 at night.
Yeah,
and it was kind of like it was her sitting down on a very patterned couch with her friends. And so I love that. I love like a very casual, like a break it down interview, like a Barbara Walters, mm-hmm. but even more like, it gets more serious like when people are friends. So maybe it's closer to like a, I don't know, maybe a Deborah Norville.
Yeah,
something.
You mostly have people you know on or mix.
Yeah, mostly people I know. The last couple of episodes, though, I have been introduced to a couple of new people that I hadn't met before, but I'm very interested in. So it's fun, and it's the basic gist of it is that, you know, interview people that everybody knows, and then people that everybody should know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's somebody like Jonathan Van Ness, who everybody knows, who I adore, and
from Queer Eye,
and also. Also seen as my hairdresser and other incarnations, but now he's too famous to do my hair. But
He did your hair before?
He did my hair for many years.
Oh, wow.
And
so you knew him when?
I knew him when, and I had started stalking him, actually, on social media from seeing Gay of Thrones, which was his Funny or Die show, wrap-up show for Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to know him. And I made him be my hairdresser, which is a great move. And so he's a fabulous, fabulous person to interview. So people like him, and then also people like Robin Tran, who is a really, really funny comedian, stand-up comedian, a writer. She's a trans woman. She's Asian American. She's very different.
Yeah.
So I really want people to get to know her. So lots of different types of people. It's really fun, and I'm enjoying it. This week we have Kathy Griffin. So everybody knows her.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah, she was on this show a few weeks ago.
Ooh, yeah.
Or a couple months ago. Yeah.
She's great.
She was so much fun to talk to, and she has quite a story to tell.
Quite a few stories. Yeah. And she and I have a long history. I've known her, you know, since I came to Los Angeles in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, she's just got a lot to say. And somebody who has been through show business in every capacity,
yeah.
You know, and she and I and Janina Garofalo in the very early 90s used to do comedy in a bookstore that was on Beverly called Big and Tall Books when there were independent bookshops everywhere.
Yeah.
And we would clear out the cafe, which was upstairs, and we would force stand-up comedy on all of the hipster people trying to read and drink coffee.
How did that go?
It went well most of the time, although a couple of times it really felt like that kind of performance art where you go somewhere with a bunch of firecrackers around your neck, like a lei, and mm-hmm. light them. You couldn't do that now, by the way, with the firecrackers. People would really panic.
Yeah, yeah. So what else do you remember from those sort of early days when you first came to L.A. to do stand-up?
I remember that we would be out all night, and I don't know where we got all the energy. In the early 90s, there was like this crazy thing where Janine would take us. Janine was sort of the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would follow her wherever she went. We would follow her little Doc Martens as they, her little size 4 Doc Martens, as they would stomp down La Brea. And we would go to Ministry, which was another coffee house. See, we would just go to the coffee houses,
mm-hmm.
which had old pastries and very strong coffee. So that's probably why we never slept.
Yeah.
And we would smoke cigarettes, and you could smoke inside of the coffee houses then. This is gross in the 90s. And at midnight, we would go and we would meet Judd Apatow and Ben Stiller and Colin Quinn Bob Odenkirk at Ministry, which was a coffee house where Meshuggah is now, which is the kosher sushi place on La Brea. And we would meet them at midnight, and they would be writing what would become the Ben Stiller show on Fox. But at that time, I didn't really know what they were doing. They were just, the boys are doing something stupid and I don't care. And so we would sit down and write. I didn't actually write anything for that, but I would be drawing pictures or sketches in my book, which I have still, maybe some of the guys. But that was like the very dawn of like independent, early indie comedy, from which came a fountain of many things. Of course, all of these people we know from different areas. Oh, and David Cross and Bob Odenkirk would be there also working on an early version of Mr. Show.
Yeah, I was listening to one of your podcast episodes where you were talking about the alternative scene versus the club comic scene in that time. Where do you feel like you fell into that? Or were you able to kind of straddle both worlds?
I was a rare breed of comedian who could somehow manage to talk my way into both worlds. And there were not that many of us. I think that there was me, maybe Patton Oswalt, and a few others where we were welcome in stand-up comedy clubs, very traditional, like the Improvs and all of the chains, and then also welcome in the alternative spaces like Luna Park or Largo or even Onyx or Pedro's. You know, all of these places that were kind of on the east side, that the farthest west we would ever venture would be Largo. And even that was on Fairfax. We would never go as far as La Brea.
Yeah.
I mean, no, La Cienega.
Yeah,
La Cienega would be like, that's like basically the horizon.
And you've been touring a lot now doing stand-up too. So how's the current tour going?
I love it. You know, I love that I get to still do comedy and travel all over the place. And for me, it's just really gratifying. I mean, I think that it's a lifestyle that I've always had. I've been a comedian since I was 14. So, you know, it's a sort of thing of like, we all wanted to run away and join the circus. And this is like kind of the closest proximity to it, where you're not practicing cruelty towards animals.
adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you started when you were 14.
Yeah.
How did that work?
I had a comedy class that I was in high school, and also a teacher who was highly inappropriate now that I look back. But she was signing us up for open mic nights at the Other Cafe, which was a very famous comedy club in San Francisco, which had shows during the week. You would see Paula Poundstone or Dana Carvey, mm-hmm. Bobcat Goldthwait, lots of people. And then also they had these open mic nights, and they would sign us up. My teacher would sign us up and we would go. And so I would do these sketches with, at that time, I was a comedy duo with Sam Rockwell, who's a
really
very famous actor now.
Yeah. But very funny too.
He's very funny. And he is, he's really talented in many different ways, but he ended up not staying in San Francisco. He went to move to New York with his mom. So I stayed in San Francisco, and I stayed with it. There was a comedy club above my parents' bookstore where I worked. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to go up there and do sets. At that comedy club, they would sell tomatoes in the front that you could throw at the performers, which, you know, this is like the mid-80s to late-80s, mm-hmm. there was a kind of, I don't know what, it was almost like a vaudeville style of performance where there were a lot of character comedians, something like Emo Phillips and Judy yeah. Tenuta and Bobcat. Bobcat, of course, has transitioned yeah. to different kinds of comedy, but mm-hmm. there was this kind of heavy, sort of very performative, character-based comedy. Pauly Shore kind of comes under that.
Is that what you were doing? Is that how you would describe what you were doing?
No, but I think that kind of comedy mm-hmm. did lend itself to a performative audience, like mm-hmm. some audience that feels justified in throwing things.
Yeah.
So there was a kind of like a rejection of the way that we look at performance and a new breed of performers that was really punk rock. And so you could sort of do anything, be anything. You could be underage in a club. You could be like Gigi Allen and throwing feces. Mm. You know, so it was like a very anarchic time, kind of a little bit before grunge, where anything was possible.
So how would you describe what your act was like in those really early days?
At that time, I was probably like, I don't know, it was real young Sheldon. Like, it was like weird, like a child.
Doogie Howser.
Like a weird Doogie Howser. It was very much like a child with the lab coat and like a stethoscope.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, why is this child here? And yet, you know, I really fell in love with the art form of it. I was very safe in comedy just because it was a world where people were inclined to try to take care of me, you know, and I had people who were very supportive, like Jerry Seinfeld or Brett Butler, mm-hmm. who were incredibly just very supportive and very willing to give me opportunities and help me out. And so, you know, I really thrived in that community. And then I got to be on Star Search International.
Oh, yeah.
And the young comedian special, that was a big Bob Hope's big thing, mm-hmm. big to do every sort of Christmas. So there was a bunch of things that happened that I was able to kind of be in comedy full time. And then I wasn't in school, and I just kept going on the road.
Yeah. I mean, you ended up opening for Jerry Seinfeld, right?
Yeah.
What do you remember from that experience?
I was in a competition where it was like for the funniest college student in America. And there were the finalists, which was myself for the West Coast and John Glazer from the Midwest. And then there was Red Johnny and the Round Guy, who were a comedy rap duo. And so we all won, and we were all given the opportunity to open for Jerry Seinfeld. And Jerry was very, very generous to me. And he said that I had a good perspective and a unique perspective, and that I would do well in comedy should I choose to follow that path in life, which I did, which is great. Mm-hmm. So he is a marvelous guy and definitely helped me feel confident. But that was really incredible. And he did a show. It was the Seinfeld Diaries had just started on
The Seinfeld Chronicles
I think something like that. Yeah, it was like
the early Seinfeld.
The very early Seinfeld. So it was like in maybe their first season, in between first and second season, or something like that, before it turned into just Seinfeld. And so it was very, it was all very new, this idea of comedians being on television and doing sitcoms. And so, and of course, that led to, of course, Roseanne and Tim Allen and quite a few comedians who were headlining their own sitcoms.
including you.
Yes. So it was like it was a good time to be in comedy. Although it was weird because my comedy was very geared towards nightclub comedy. And mm-hmm. I think I was much more raunchy because I was trying to convince audiences that I was older than I was.
Oh, yeah.
And so my comedy was like really kind of blue and, you know, appropriate on my comedy specials on HBO and things like that. But when you're hired by Disney, as they kind of, you know, brought me into their fold and tried to make a show for me, it was really a strange thing. Like, it was like they were trying to make a pickle into a cucumber.
Yeah. How did that happen that you got connected with ABC and Disney and they decided to make the All-American Girl?
Well, ultimately, the whole thing was they offered the most money.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's an easy decision to make mm-hmm. if you're young and I didn't really understand. Mm-hmm. Now, if I look back and I go, oh, I should have made a deal with HBO.
Right.
And had a show that, like, your lead-in could have been Arliss
mm-hmm.
or Dream On.
Yeah.
You know, and then it would have been more of an appropriate thing. But I didn't know. Like, I didn't really know. And I had a lot of people who were working with me who were just like, let's get the money,
yeah.
you know, and I just didn't really get it. But, you know, I learned.
Yeah, well, you ended up on this lineup with all these, you know, great female comics, mm-hmm. Roseanne and mm-hmm. Ellen mm-hmm. and Brett Butler, who you
right.
mentioned.
Yeah.
So there was, I mean, there was something happening there.
Yes.
And those, you know, shows were great as well in their time. But so when you started making this show, were there things that you wanted to do with it that ABC, Disney just said, you know, no, that's not going to
yeah.
work?
Yeah. I mean, we would have like vibrator jokes in
yeah.
there and they would have to be cut. And it mm-hmm. was really, it was devastating kind of. But because the show was like an 8:30 show, 8 o'clock mm-hmm. show, it was really hard. If you went into the 9 o'clock hour, then you had Roseanne and you had Ellen
yeah.
and you had much more leeway to do a lot more. Also, they were adults.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still, even though I was in my 20s, I was still considered like a child in the way that the show is framed. I'm in the family
home.
Yeah,
it's a very family kind of show. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and also the fact that we were Asian American, there was a sort of a thing of like, there was this need to sort of steer it toward a safer territory
mm-hmm.
because they were maybe being so outrageous that we were racially different. I mean,
mm-hmm.
That's a crazy kind of justification, but it's not, it's, I think it's all underneath, like these things that the decisions that they were making were kind of like underneath everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it was weird. But there was something that happened in the show that kind of changed everything, which was, I think it was Frank Wells. He was like he died
mm-hmm.
like in the beginning of our run. And so we had to move everything to another studio, which kind of, so that they could use our studio for his funeral. And it was a very strange
oh, really?
Thing. So that there was all of this like weird, like movement around the show that kind of led to our kind of feeling dis-ease.
Mm-hmm. When you think back to it now, and it's been what, 25 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how do you think about that time? Or do you think about, oh, I wish I had done something differently? Or what are your thoughts about it now?
Oh, God. I think that it's really like I should have. Well, I mean, my main thing is I should have gone and made a deal with a network that have really understood my point
mm-hmm.
of view. So that would have been an HBO or
yeah,
whoever.
Yeah.
That's the main regret. But other than that, it's really like, well, you know, it happened the way it should have happened. I should have handled things a little bit better, but I also didn't know who I was as a performer. I didn't really understand who I was as an artist. And
mm-hmm.
actually being canceled helped me really become the stand-up comedian that I was supposed to be.
Yeah.
So I became a better comedian for it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if I had that early success as a television personality, I may not have felt the need to go back and develop as a stand-up
mm-hmm.
comedian.
Yeah, I mean, I could be wrong, but looking at like the credits for the show, you're not credited as a writer or
no.
a producer,
no.
which seemed odd to me,
yeah.
considering
yeah.
thinking something about like Seinfeld,
right.
and they were all, you know, producing, writing
mm-hmm.
their shows. So, I mean, what was that about? And where is that, you know, how did that kind of come to be? And how do you feel about it?
I just didn't know. And also, like, I was so terrified of the responsibility of having all of this on me. I sort of thought, well, if I am not a producer, maybe it wouldn't be so much, like, I could take some of this load off.
Yeah.
You know, that if I am not a writer, which I never was, they never opened that door for me anyway. I would have to force that open if at all. You know, so it, like, it just didn't occur to me because I just didn't know. And also, like, I didn't know anybody in show business who had been through this, and I didn't know any other Asian American comedians that I could ask about.
There weren't many of them.
No, and so it was like, I didn't really get it. And the people that I would have asked maybe just had a different perspective on it. And they had more agency. You know, somebody like Ellen had a lot more agency coming into this because she had been a very, very prominent stand-up comedian for many years at that point. And I was opening for her. So to me, it was like, I just didn't have the knowledge or capacity to understand, like, I should demand that. Because I just didn't know.
Yeah.
But, of course, now I know.
What's the story behind the Quentin Tarantino episode of All-American Girl?
Well, Quentin and I have been dating. I dated him in between, probably the craziest time for him, which was in between Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
And so we were, he was always around. Like, he was always around. Like, he would be there. And you know, he, I don't know if he had suggested it. We had suggested it. I'm not sure how it came about, but he wanted to be on the show. He loves sitcoms. We had also both done Golden Palace, not together, but we had done episodes of, it's the Golden Girl spinoff. He played an Elvis impersonator.
Oh, yeah.
So he, he's very appreciative of the multicam genre. And so he really wanted to be part of it. I mean, you know, and at that time, like, we were hanging out all the time. Like, he had just bought out the inventory of Video Archives, which is his old job at the video store. And he had 8,000 movies on VHS and DVD.
Oh, wow.
And he had a special TV that letterboxed everything. It didn't even ask you. Like, everything was letterboxed from, you know, all of these, like, old movies we would watch up to Family Ties was letterboxed.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we were just together a lot and hanging out. And so, you know, the writers pitched it and we did an episode that was all about kind of following the maybe the pattern of Pulp Fiction and had a lot of fun. And we, you know, they spent a lot on the episode and it sort of became this very big thing. And, you know, I'm really appreciative that we have that. It's so 90s.
Yeah.
It's like the most 90s thing ever.
Desmond, I don't like the idea of having to visit my boyfriend in some prison where he ends up getting his lungs cut out by some hard timer with a homemade shiv.
I'm your boyfriend?
Yeah, I guess you are. Which is why I don't like this.
Look, it's not that big of a deal. Nobody gets hurt by what I do.
But it's illegal.
You're trying to tell me you've never photocopied sheet music or made your own tape from some album?
Well, yeah, but
that's
not...
Well, that's all I do, all right? Except I do it on a much bigger scale.
So I appreciated him and we had a good time on that episode.
And then I was reading that sort of the way that the show ended was they were kind of, there was talks about kind of turning it into a different kind of show, like more of like a Friends kind of show.
Yeah.
So what happened there? I mean, is that something that you would have wanted to do and it didn't work out, or was that their idea? Or
yeah, it was many people trying to figure out why or how we're going to make this work. Like, okay, I think it was more like, we're going to try to make this show more adult as opposed to like a family show, because they realized that Impulse was wrong, that they should have framed me in more of an adult
context.
It's
more of your
context.
Sensibility, too.
Yeah. So that we were trying to do that. I think that it, you know, I was just all for trying to shift it and make it into something better and something that we could live in. And so that was actually a fun episode in itself. It was almost like a pilot to do something different. And but the problem with it was it just didn't. It was almost too little too late. Like, we're trying to, like, fix a problem we should have dealt with in the beginning. So, you know, I understand. It was also, there was a big backlash from the Korean community because at that time, the LA riots had just happened. And they were very controlling over their public persona. And they didn't like me because I was a woman. I was such a really, really raunchy comedian. And, you know, they didn't want me as a representative. So that was a very difficult thing that happened too.
Yeah, I mean, how did that feel? Because you're out here, you know, it's like the first, one of the first, or the first, depending on, you know, what you're looking at, the sitcom starring Asian American family.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have the Korean American community kind of, you know, have that response. How did that feel?
It was terrible. And I was so angry. And I would confront them personally on it. Like, I would call all these ministers of churches who were like threatening to protest. And I was like, what? I would call them at home.
Mm-hmm.
And like,
yeah,
on the, like a landline that we had from my house, by my coffee table. And I would ask them about it. And, you know, they would get really angry. I was calling like this reporter at the LA Times, who was like at the metro section. She covered all the crime in Koreatown, and she had moved over to entertainment for one thing so that she could do this whole expose about mm-hmm. how this wasn't a really, really Korean show. And it was like so crazy. And so I had all these arguments with people, and but fortunately they all died. And so now I'm the old one now, which is great, because I'm the establishment in terms of like Korean comedians or comedians of Asian American mm-hmm. comedians all sort of cite me as an influence, which is the best part of it. So, but it is something like, it is like a generational thing. And it's also like the old kind of immigrant mindset and this very patriarchal culture that Koreans are, you know, that's, it's hard. It's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of your show got a lot of attention again a few years ago when Fresh Off the Boat came mm-hmm. on, because they were saying, you know, this is the first since All American Girl. And that show's had its own backlash issues in some ways too, or you know, controversies. How did you feel about that show when it came out, and just the fact that was it frustrating to you that it was the first one since
yours?
Yeah,
it should not have taken 24, 25, 23 years for them to do it again. Although I am friendly with everybody over there.
Mm-hmm.
I was familiar with the show from Eddie Huang's bio, mm-hmm. from his biography that it's based on. And so I was talking to him about it when they were first approaching the show being made, and how all of his issues and dealing with it. And then he eventually left the show. And, you know, I love Randall. I love Constance. They're all great over there, and they've done a great job. I think it's a great time for it. I actually appear in the first season.
Mm-hmm.
They're watching me on television, which I think is a great thing.
Yeah,
and
that's a good tribute.
Yeah, I'm really proud of them, and I'm really excited that the show has had such a great long life.
Yeah,
and you know, all of these stars have emerged from it.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like there are more opportunities for Asian American,
mm-hmm.
especially in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with Crazy Rich Asians, obviously got a lot of attention for that. Do you see that? You know, does it feel different now than when you were starting?
I think so. I mean, I hope so. But the thing is that when I was starting, the you know, my TV show and the Joy Luck Club came out at the same time. And there was all of this talk about, now we're going to actually look towards Asian Americans,
mm-hmm.
and this being a thing in television and movies. And it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so I'm hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see more. And I have seen some more. But I think that there's still some way to go in terms of diversity, but I'm very grateful that we have stars like Awkwafina, Ken Jeong, Randall, of course, Constance, who are out there and doing great. So it's really, I mean, that's meaningful.
Yeah, Ali Wong too has become,
she's amazing.
Huge, and
she's great. She's actually incredible, and her comedy specials. The last two, the first time I've seen an Asian American woman do a comedy special, and that's really significant. I mean, because I don't know any other ones. So
mm-hmm.
that was really, really great.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Sorry.
It's okay.
Lucia.
And then just a couple weeks ago, Saturday Night Live cast the first Asian American actor,
Bowen
Yang, which is also, it was insane to me that he's the first,
I know,
on the show.
I know.
In the 45 years that it's been on.
It's crazy. I mean, I think Rob Schneider is half Filipino.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
I think that's it. But yeah, Bowen's great. Bowen's a friend of mine, and he's so talented. He did a great job. He did a great job on Weekend Update.
Yeah, I saw
that.
He was
so funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just great because he's so him,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's really powerful. And I think that they did a good thing hiring him. He had been on the show actually before. for a while as a writer. So it's great to see him on camera.
Yeah. And of course, you know, it was coupled with this sort of horrible saga of the other actor, that the comedian that they hired, Shane Gillis, who we quickly found out was had a lot of problematic things in his act. What was your response to that? Because there was kind of a divide. You know, I saw a lot of Asian American comedians who were outraged by what the some of the stuff that he said.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of other comedians who were kind of defending comedians' right to say whatever they want. So it was an interesting conversation. I mean, what was your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, it's not for me, but I think that comedians who take risks are really important, and if their definition of risk is racism, then let that be it. You know, I think that it's sad that comedians think that being edgy is about being racist. But, you know, if they want to define it that way, that's totally fine. You know, it's just like comedians like to be challenged by the status quo, and they're going to overstep. That's the nature of comedy, and we're all going to do it at some point. And it's sort of the degree of in which we do it is, you know, kind of like, it's not up to us, and it's not up to, it's sort of that sort of society to decide. And, you know, I think that he'll be fine because what's great is that he's got a lot of exposure for people who like that kind of comedy can go find it. And that's really big. So he's got a big boost. I think
that's what
good.
I thought. I think the whole thing may have helped him more than it hurt him.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure he would have done well on SNL in that environment, you know.
You know, who knows? But it's really, I think that it you know, it did good by him, then, that people who like that kind of comedy can go seek him out. He's got a lot to say now about it. And you know, cuz there's a big market of comedians out there who are a big market of an audience members who just they want to see it their way, and they want it to go back to the way it was. So you know there is an audience out there for that.
Have you had to deal with any of that in your career in terms of offending people or getting people upset about stuff? And how how do you handle it when it happens?
Well, I think that it's like, I feel a little bit like, I think that these kinds of things help. Ultimately, language helps us understand how to be a better society. And I think that it is good, you know, that cancel culture, a lot of it is really good, you know, and then when you're victimized by it, you know, maybe we need to learn to do better. So I don't know, like, I feel, you know, it is more about like relying on your skill as a comedian and kind of as an ambassador of goodwill. Like, I think comedians are just, we're here to do good work. We're just here to be funny. So hopefully we don't overstep too much, but that you can survive within it is really a test of your ability.
Yeah, I mean, the other bit that I was thinking about is there's been a lot of talk about Dave Chappelle and his recent special. I don't know if did you see his most recent special?
Yeah.
So, I mean, one bit that maybe has gotten less attention is his riff on bisexuality.
If it's one thing that the L's and the G's agree on, is that the B's are fucking gross. They seem greedy to the L's and the G's, you know what I mean? They're just sitting in the back seat like, yeah, man, I'll fuck anybody in this car. What's going on, man?
So when you see something like that, I mean, on the one hand, you know, comedians should be able to say whatever they want, but how do you take that when you see that?
But I think that there is like, but that his, it's his truth. Like, and I believe that there is like a hidden truth in there. I think there is a lot of prejudice against the bisexual community. It even within the LGBTQIA community, because there's that thing of bisexuality is sometimes it's an identity that we claim when we're not ready to fully be who we are. That is sometimes people's prejudice towards it because it's assumed that it's a lie. Also, it's assumed that it's convenient that we can choose. And then it sort of justifies this idea that being gay is a choice, which is something that's been used against us for so long. So there's a lot of biases that are hard to put words to because it kind of lends itself to your own homophobia that exists within the queerness that I am. You know, I really try to like exempt myself from homophobia, but I realize like when it exists within me and when it exists in my own being towards other bisexuals, I tend to not believe it. And I tend to think like, well, this is wrong and they're wrong and they don't really know who they are. And so it's, it's something that I can, I welcome the criticism because I've already been through it.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's weird. But yeah, so it's the one part of the gay community that we're kind of like, eh, I think they could, they feel like they could do without us.
So you felt that almost like homophobia from the gay community for being bi?
Yeah, totally internalized homophobia that is very hard to really, you know, recognize. But you have to kind of go, well, I see it and I know it. And I don't think there's ever going to be a time that I'm going to walk away from being bisexual. I don't think that there will be a time that I identify solely as a lesbian or solely as heterosexual. But I also don't think that there's two genders. So I think that bisexual has a, there's inherently problems with their thinking that, you know, that we are binary. Mm-hmm. None of us are, there's no real such thing. Everybody has degrees of gender. So there's a lot of problems with the B.
Coming up, Margaret addresses the backlash she received after playing an exaggerated North Korean character at the Golden Globes opposite Amy Poehler and Tina Fey.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to my conversations with other performers at this week's Netflix is a Joke Fest, like Tig Notaro, Nick Kroll, Nicole Byer, and more, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts to let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Margaret Cho. So what I want to do now is kind of a speed round, going through some of the things that you've done that we didn't get a chance to talk about yet, and if there's sort of a memory or a story that jumps out to you. So the first is your first late night stand-up performance, which you can, do you remember what it was?
Yes, it was the Dennis Miller Show.
Oh, okay.
When he was liberal.
Yeah.
He used to be, he was always kind of
libertarian.
I used
to like that show.
I liked
or
that
Dennis,
show a lot.
Was it, I watched Dennis Miller Live, was it that, or there was the one before that?
It was the one before
that.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was like the one that was kind of like Letterman or like, it was the one that was more fashioned towards like that, like it, and I think I've also I also did the very first Jon Stewart show.
Oh yeah,
which was on MTV, which was very much that kind of like not a daily show behind a desk. It was sitting with like performers, and you know, Buffalo Tom was on.
Yeah. Things so like what do you remember about the Dennis Miller performance?
I remember that I when I auditioned, I bombed, and it was a full house, and I bombed so bad, but he was in the back. He was the only one laughing.
And he probably has a very distinct laugh.
Yeah. You could hear, yeah. But he was really, really laughing. I got the show from that. And I remember that I had on a suit, which is so weird to think about. Betsy Johnson suit. This was in the 90s. And I was so excited. That was like the first thing. I think I did that show twice because I think I did it once and then I was back like the next week. So sometimes you would get in that thing where you would be a comedian that was on kind of like a call, like they would call you if somebody dropped out.
Yeah.
So that I was that for that show once, and then also about 10 or 12 times for Arsenio Hall.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the main show that I did probably the most of my late night comedy shows on.
What do you think happened to Dennis Miller?
You know, I think that he, just really kind of, you know, sometimes libertarians, they can become very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Libertarianism, I think there is, because they're free to go anywhere and make their own decisions, they do sometimes go to this place of far right.
Yeah.
Which maybe that's what happened to him. I have a hard time believing that.
Yeah.
I think he's a smart guy, and
I
really don't understand. I always respected him as a comedian and liked him very much personally, but the fact that he's conservative, it's just odd to me.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, because comedians, you think they're mostly a liberal crew.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's very few conservative comedians. There's a handful, but not too many.
Yeah, and they're always like guys that you're like, are they really comedians? Like, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Like Glenn Beck?
No.
I don't think
he counts as a comedian.
Yeah, I mean, there is some sort of element of mirth around what they do, but I can't really see. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think of comedy as being very liberal art form, but I don't know.
So one of your earliest movie roles was in Face Off, which is a classic.
Yes.
Do you have any good Nicolas Cage and or John Travolta stories?
John Travolta and I, I would go and eat lunch in his trailer, and one time he ate an entire boysenberry pie, a 9-inch boysenberry pie with a fork. He didn't even cut it in slices.
Wow.
Ate the whole pie. This is following a beef Wellington. So I actually would be doing that same kind of eating. It's like when being in his presence is like being in the presence of a king.
Yeah.
So you do want to do what he does. And so I ate so much that they had to put an elasticized panel in the back of my suit that I wore, because the film takes place over a very short period of time.
Right.
So it's like a few days, actually, not a long period of time. So I had to wear the same thing every day, but I had to have them cut a fat panel in that they put elastic in the back.
Because you were just spending too much time with John Travolta.
And eating. And half of the movie, Nicolas Cage was in character, so he really hated us because we were all in the FBI. So if you're in a movie with Nicolas Cage and you're like not on his side, then he's really shitty to you because he's in character. So half of it, he was really shitty to me. And then, you know, he was kind of mean anyway, but I think it was because of the character.
Yeah.
So he really yelled at me in one scene. But we were like, he's supposed to like collapse and dead or not or almost dead. And he was really it was weird. But he was very angry most of it. But I think that was a character based.
What did
decision.
He yell at you about?
I think I said something wrong, or I said the line wrong, or something to that effect, but he was in character, so it was kind of like he was just lashing out as his character in it, which I think it's okay.
Yeah.
I don't mind.
One of my favorite performances of yours was as Kim Jong-il in 30 Rock, which you did a bunch of times.
Yeah.
And in food news, you've had enough to eat today. Now here with the weather is Johnny Mountain.
North Korea, everything sunny all the time, always. Good time, beach party. Back to you, Aloreeb.
How did that come about? And what do you remember from that?
Tina Fey just asked me, and I was so excited to be a part of it. And I just went in. And when you do that show, well, that show was so, everybody on the show was so hugely famous. So a lot of the time, you were working with their body double. Like they were, well, especially Tracy Morgan. He had a lot. So a lot of the scenes that I did with him had his body double in place. And then he would shoot his side with you. And then the same thing with Alec Baldwin. But Tina, of course, is so hands-on with that show. So she was there with my scenes with her for everything. Mm-hmm. And most of the time when I wasn't in scenes with her, she would be there. So there was a lot of her input, of course, but, you know, it was sort of different when I was shooting with Tracy or Alec. And then, you know, again, it's like, it's a very famous show, but the part about that is they didn't do a lot of shooting on the street, like Sex and the City.
Yeah, it was mostly a studio, right?
Yeah, so you were sort of enclosed, and so you didn't really see anybody, but it was really cool.
Yeah, I remember when it came, when the first time it happened, I feel like people were like, not sure if it was you at first. It was kind of a fun thing to figure out.
Yeah.
And then you did a bit with, was it with Tina and Amy on the Golden Globes?
Yes.
Cho Young-ja wanted to come up here with us. Are you enjoying the show so far?
No, what? You don't think it's fun to see all these big movie stars and like Crazy Eyes and Prince? It's a fun show.
In North Korea, we know how to put on a show. This is not a show. No, you know, have 1,000 baby playing guitar at the same time. You know, have people holding up many cards to make one big picture. You know, have Dennis Rodman. No basketball at all.
Right. Someone dropped the ball on Rodman. Right. We'll get on that. Right. We'll get right on that.
Also, I think that Orange is the New Black should be in drama category. You know, it's funny, but not ha-ha fun.
So that became like a big thing, too.
A really weird thing. Well, it was funny because it was with... was Meryl Streep and Benedict Cumberbatch, and I was trying to get a picture with Meryl for Insta, and I was holding up this like thing with her, and so she gave me a kiss, and Benedict Cumberbatch photobombed us, and then right behind us was Harvey Weinstein, probably his very last Golden Globes.
Yeah, he's in the. Is he in the picture behind
he's
you?
In the, he. I think he's not in the picture, but he was right there. Yeah. And right behind him was Prince.
Oh wow!
So it was like this very kind of ominous. The last.
What a group.
Golden Globes that you saw these people at. I was too nervous to speak to Prince. Eric Gurian, who is he's one of Tina's main writer guys. He was there, and he asked Prince to come to our party, our after party.
Nice. And he did.
And I think he did show up later than I left, but Prince showed up after.
Yeah, and I know that appearance kind of caused a lot of online discussion.
Yeah.
How did you take that, or what was your kind of take on it?
Well, again, it was kind of like, I think it was the early days for cancel culture.
Right.
So probably I would have been canceled if they had known to put words to it. But we hadn't codified cancellation yet. So we
got in right under the wire.
Right in under, like, before cancellation became a thing. But then... I didn't understand because I am Korean.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, how could you portray a Korean? I don't know. It was like a very weird, and it was mostly white people, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
So I think it's like, it doesn't help us. Like, cancel culture doesn't help us, or political correctness doesn't help us when it serves to try to intimidate you into invisibility.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, there's a thing if like an Asian person is doing an Asian character, the accent is acceptable. I think it's like if it's who you are, then it's kind of okay. But it's very weird when people are very agitated about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I had fun.
Another more recent performance of yours that I loved was on High Maintenance.
Oh yeah.
Which felt like a really different kind of thing for you.
Yes.
Just like, because that show is kind of ultra realism and very down and dirty kind of
so
thing.
So cool.
So was that fun to do?
I loved it. I love that show. And I love like it. It's really like its message and its spirit and the way to shoot it. It's really beautiful. Like, it's really, it's the closest thing that we have to, like, Ingmar Bergman. Like, it's, like, serious. Like, it's, like, this very European, like, filmmaking style that's really, I mean, it is cinema verite. Mm-hmm.
Were you a fan of the show before you went on? Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. And I just love their spirit. I love them. I think they're so good. You know, it's a really great show to be on, and I had such a fun time on it.
And I think that the last one we have to end on is The Masked Singer, of course.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which obviously is huge.
So huge.
Why did you want to do that, and what did you get out of the experience?
Well, I love singing, and it looked fun to me. And, they give you a lot of money. So it's like all of the things that I love.
Except then you have to be in this poodle costume.
Yeah.
Was that part hard?
Of hot, but then also I love the costume. It's so pretty.
Yeah.
So that part I loved. I wish they let me keep it, but I couldn't. I guess it's going to be in some kind of big museum where they put all the masks somewhere. Some kind of a theme restaurant maybe. But I had a great time. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really cool. You get to work with some amazing vocal coaches and amazing like choreographers and costumers. And, you know, I was really nervous because I play Ken Jeong's sister on his TV show.
Yeah.
So I thought he was going to know because he's been like working with me. I've been working with him since like, you know, 25 years or maybe more. He opened for me on like shows on the road as a comedian 25 years ago.
Yeah.
When he was in med school.
But he had no idea.
He didn't know. But I think like that was really, I was like, how could you not know? It's like me, but he didn't know. So that was, I kind of got in. I was lucky there, but it was so fun.
Yeah.
I loved it. And I really love, I think I love, I don't know who I love now. I like the butterfly a lot in this season. It's very cool.
So we end every episode by asking comedians, what's the last thing that made you laugh really hard? You can think of it as kind of a recommendation of something you saw on TV or a performer you saw live or just anything that really made you laugh.
I love like when Bill Hader was on SNL, and I just watched this the other day, rewatched it, is when he does Stefan,
yeah,
like with the fall recommendations of what to see. I love all of the Dateline, Bill Hader's, anything he does with the Dateline people. Yeah. It's really funny.
He's so funny.
He's great.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and doing this today.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for listening to my conversation with the legend herself, Margaret Cho. You can get tickets to see Margaret tonight and tomorrow night at Netflix is a Joke Fest in LA by clicking the link in the description for this episode. And she has lots more tour dates as well at margaretcho.com/tour. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.